All right. Well, thank you, everyone. Thanks, Tobias and all the organizers. So yeah, so my background was electrical engineering at the beginning. Then I did some computational neuroscience. But my lab is mostly experimental. But now I have kind of the language and the tools to communicate with the theory people. And you will see how that kind of influences our work a little bit. So I'm going to be talking about neural pathways for flexible interpretation of sounds. And although the program says this is a tutorial, because I'm giving only one talk, this will be kind of a tutorial seminar in one. And as you see from here, our lab works in rodents, in particular mice. And I want to start talking about the phenomena that we study with this cute example from the visual system, where you see these characters that look like A, B, and C, but these characters that look like 12, 13, and 14. But of course, you recognize that the ones in the middle are exactly the same stimulus that is interpreted differently depending on the context in which it appears. So in our lab, we want to study phenomena in which the same stimulus produces different percepts or different responses, behavioral responses, depending on the context or the state of the animal or the past. In particular, we want to study phenomena such as selective attention, where you have to listen to my voice and ignore the sounds outside, or the effects of expectation on perception and decision-making and behavior. For example, where this idea that if you hear a sound at the expected moment, you will respond faster and you will perceive more accurately what the sound is, as opposed to if the sound appears unexpectedly. And we also want to study the effects of rule switching. For example, the English word shoe and the French word choux may have completely different meanings, and you will have to adapt depending on your environment to what the correct interpretation of the sound is. So again, what we want to address here, what we want to understand is how the same sound comes into the system, in this case the nervous system, or you could think of it as a machine as well, and be rerouted to drive one action or a different action depending on context, reward, or the past experience of the animal. So let's start with a basic question. What does it mean to understand such a cognitive process? And I argue that understanding a process like this requires answering three questions. First, we want to characterize what happens to the behavior of the organism, to the animal or the human, when it switches from one context to another. Then we want to understand where in the brain is this same sound that comes into the system being rerouted to drive one action or another. And third, we want to know how is this flexibility implemented at the level of neural circuits. Is it a changes in synapses? Is it integration from top-down signals or anything else? The first two questions are addressable in humans and non-human primates very well. We can ask all questions about psychophysics and many questions about what parts of the brain, at least the correlates of what parts of the brain are activated for particular processes. But I would argue that answering the how it happens at the level of the mechanisms of the circuits is harder in these species. So we take advantage of rodents, in particular mice and rats, to try to go all the way from here to here and produce some more concrete hypotheses that then we can go back into the primates and humans and specifically test those. So the idea is that rodents allow us to very efficiently explore the space of hypotheses so that then we can go and ask more precise questions in the humans. So how do we study auditory cognition in rodents? I'm going to show you here one example of the type of tasks that we use that forms the basis of many different paradigms. So in this case, let's start with the rats. We have a box that has three ports, and the animal initiates a trial by poking in the center port. After some silent delay, the animal hears a sound. If the sound is high pitch, he has to go to the right. If it's low pitch, he has to go to the left. That is the basic task, and let me show you how it looks when a rat performs that task. So this is a very well-trained rat. It takes about 1 to 2 weeks to get to this level of performance, and you can see that they perform very fast, very well, in about 600 trials in 1 hour. We have the same type of tasks for mice. You can still hear the sounds a little quieter here. And I wanted to show you the difference here so that you see that both animals learn to do these tasks very well. They also perform 600 to 800 trials in an hour. And of course, the idea of working with mice is that now you can use all the fancier genetic tools to dissect the circuits in terms of specific cell types or cells that project from one place to another or particular genes. Now, what we do, one of the advantages also of working with rodents is that we can have systems for high throughput behavioral training of animals. So in our lab, we have a set of rigs that are just copies of same rig over and over and over, where a technician just puts an animal in, writes the name, press enter, and the computer knows all the parameters that it needs to have to train the animals. So we can actually have a very efficient way to train animals, and then all the data just goes to a central repository server that then we can get it into our workstations. And with a system like this, we can have not only kind of a wide exploration of parameters at the behavioral level of the different tasks that we want to study, but also we can collect large data sets if we want to have very detailed models of behavior. And we will have a pipeline of animals that are ready for experimentation, that we want to record activity from different brain areas or manipulate activity with optogenetics or anything we want to do, right? So this has been very useful to explore many different cognitive tasks. And today I want to mention briefly two tasks and focus mostly on a third one. So let me introduce three of the tasks that we've been working with in the past. The first one is about cross-modal attention. And in this paper with colleagues at Cold Spring Harbor, what we had was imagine the basic task where the animal enters the center port, but he's presented with two simultaneous stimulus. One is a sound and one is a light. And we tell the animal which one is the one they're supposed to pay attention to. In this case, if the animal has to attend to the light, then it should follow the light to get the water reward. So if the light appears on the right, he has to go to the right. If the light appears on the left, he has to go to the left. In a different block of trials, the animal has to pay attention to the sound. So now if the sound is high pitch, he has to go to the right. If the sound is low pitch, he has to go to the left, right? So it's a relatively simple task for humans in particular. For mice, it's a little tricky to get them to do it, but they actually manage to do it if we organize the task block by block. And just to clarify, it has been challenging to get these animals to do the attentional switching per trial by queuing every trial, but we can definitely achieve it per blocks. And that allows us to study different mechanisms about cross-modal attention, and in particular in this paper, my colleagues were studying a schizophrenia-related gene, and we found that the loss of this gene in the thalamic reticular nucleus impaired the ability of the animals to suppress the relevant stimuli. And that's something that can really only be achieved in the mouse thanks to the genetic manipulations that are possible with that specificity. Any questions about this task? So let me talk about a different task. In this task, we were exploring what we could call attention in time. It's this idea that expectation about when something is going to happen affects our perception and our actions. So in this case, we trained rats in the same kind of paradigm of the animal goes into the center, but in this case, he's not hearing just one sound, he's hearing a set of sounds, kind of a cloud of tones, and one of them is a frequency-modulated sound the animal has to detect. And it has to report if that appears in the higher frequencies or in the lower frequencies. And the way we manipulate expectation in time is that we had two periods within the trial, one that we call early and one that we call late. And in a first block of trials, we presented the target, this frequency-modulated sound, most of the time early, but every now and then we presented it late. And in a second block of trials, we presented the target most of the time late, but sometimes early. So you could imagine now that we can have the same exact stimulus on the same cloud with the same target presented here in a condition where the animal is expecting it to appear there, or presented in the same place, the same stimulus, but in a condition where he's not expecting it. And we can ask questions about how is the perception of the animal influenced by expectation, and then we find that the animals are actually slower responding when it's unexpected. They're not as good at discriminating or detecting it, basically, when the sound happens and what the sound was. And when we go into the auditory cortex and record what the representation of these sounds is, we find that the responses in the auditory cortex are modulated by the expectation of the animal. So then you get stronger responses when the sound is expected, and these responses correlate in a trial-by-trial basis with the performance of the animal.
So the amplitude higher, or is it more synchronized activity? What do you mean?
So the finding here is that the number of spikes that a neuron elicits for that particular sound is higher when the sound is expected. We didn't test much about synchronization of rhythms, but this is a result that was consistent both the evoked LFP and the firing rate of individual neurons. Any questions about this paradigm?
Yeah, what is the time scale? So what is the time?
So this was about
difference between the early and the late in particular.
Yeah, so this was about 500 milliseconds. So it is relatively short, and the challenge here is mostly about you want to have the animal fixated, or at least like in the center port, but rodents are very impatient. So part of the challenge is to train these animals to really wait there until the target comes so that they can get reward. And we're becoming experts in how to train rodents, and we're still exploring different strategies to get process more efficient. Yes?
Did you check whether this was also visible earlier in IC or something like that?
No, so at this point we haven't, and the only thing, so that's a good question. So whenever we find something that happens higher up in the hierarchy, for example, in the auditory cortex, one wonders, is it really appearing there for the first time, or is it inherited from early stages? So we don't know the answer.
But it didn't necessarily be carried on from earlier stages, right?
Or it could be fed back to earlier stages, and the brain is a loop, right? But we haven't tested that yet, so I don't have an answer for you. What we do know is that if you inactivate the auditory cortex, the animal is not very good at performing the task. So we know information has to flow through that stage, but we don't know if the enhancement of activity happens there, if it only happens there, or if it's inherited from anywhere else. Okay, so let me introduce the last task, which is the one I'm going to focus on for the rest of the talk. So in this case, what we call adaptive categorization of sounds is a task in which I mentioned that high frequencies, the animal has to go to the right side, low frequencies, it has to go to the left, but I never said where the boundary that defines what is high frequency and what is low frequency is, because that is arbitrarily set by the experimenter. So in a first block of trials, we set it somewhere here, and in the next block of trials, we set it somewhere here. So that the same sound, in this case 7 kilohertz, belongs to the low frequency categories, meaning go to the left, or to the high frequency categories, go to the right. And now you can see where I'm going. We want to explore what could be the changes in representation of the same sound when it's driving completely different actions.
So that means you use a whole continuum of frequencies. So first I understood you basically have just two discrete frequencies.
Yeah, I'm about to show you that. Yeah. So one easy way to train the animals to do this is to use discrete frequencies. So first you train them to do 16 versus 7. So 16 go to the right, 7 kilohertz go to the left. And then in the next block, you ask them to do 7 versus 3. And then you switch them like that. But once they can do the task, what you can do is you start switching block by block every 200 or 300 trials, and then you evaluate the performance of the animal that we're going to plot in the following way. We're going to plot what is the percentage of trials the animal chooses to go to the side on the right, so rightward, for each of the frequencies. And we said already that 16 kilohertz should drive the animal to the right, and then 7 kilohertz should drive the animal to not the right, right? So we can also present all the other frequencies and get a psychometric curve. Once we switch the animal to the next block, the animal has to realize that he's in a new, let's call it environment, from trial and error, and perform differently. And in this case, we estimate another psychometric curve. So the animal is switching between these two curves, or if you will, between two different subjective category boundaries that he has in his head as to what is a high frequency and what is a low frequency, right? And we can get animals to switch several times within the same behavioral session. This is an example of one animal, one session, where we're just plotting the percentage of trials the animal is going to the right. This is a kind of like a moving average. As the blocks switch from 7 means go right, and then 7 means go left, and 7 means goes right, and then left. And animals, again, are performing between 600, sometimes 1,000 trials. So we can actually switch many times. And we can explore what is the representation of these sounds as the animals switch, and what happens if we manipulate different cells as the animals switch back and forth. So let's go back to our main questions that we presented at the beginning. What we want to do in this particular example task is to answer what happens to the behavior of the animal. So how long does it take the animal to switch to the new block of trials? And we want to answer not only a detailed characterization of the behavior, but we want to generate some computational models that can make account for the behavioral data and make predictions about what neurons would be necessary to perform such a computation. So today I won't go into the details of the models, but I'm happy to discuss that after the talk or maybe any time during the week. The next question will be, where in the brain is this sound information being rerouted to drive the different actions? And to ask this question, we've been monitoring activity from different parts of the brain and inactivating different parts of the brain as the animals perform the task, identifying what are the regions that are necessary and are playing an important role in this process. And of course, what we want to get to is to how this flexibility is implemented. And to ask these questions, we can go into the details of the circuit and manipulate individual cell types and monitor cells of different classes to see who is producing a particular computation. Today, I'm going to focus on a story related to where in the brain this process could be happening. And in the discussion that we're going to have on Thursday, we can explore a little more the how this happens and do we have the right tools to ask these questions. So let's start with the neural pathways from sound to action. So most of what we've been discussing in the last week that I've been here is what happens from the ear to the cortex. And maybe only in the songbird and some presentations in the bat, we saw that these things relate to the behavior of the animal. So information has to go out somehow to behavior. So let's think about what are the possible pathways that information will flow from the ears to the muscles. The sound enters and goes through many stages through the brainstem, and then information reaches the auditory thalamus and eventually the auditory cortex. Of course, there's going to be feedback both to the thalamus and inferior colliculus and other places. But from any of these stages, we could have circuits that mediate action. So we have some circuits that mediate the startle response, and those don't even need the colliculus. We have some orienting behaviors that depend on the colliculus. We have fear conditioning to sounds that depends on the auditory thalamus going through the amygdala, and we have other things that could happen via the cortical circuits. So we want to ask, at what stage in these pathways the representation of the sound will change depending on what the meaning of that sound is? And one way to ask this is we can record from neurons at each stage in animals that are implanted with tetrodes as the animals perform the task. So let me show you an example of what happens when we record from auditory cortical neurons during this task. We find that when we present a particular sound, let's call it S, 7 kilohertz, under one condition, when the animal means go to the right, you get a nice response. So this is a 100 millisecond sound that is presented. The animal over here is waiting in the center port. He hears a sound, and over here he makes his choice. And we get a nice response to that sound. When the animal switches to the next block and starts going to the other side, in this case the left, the response of that neuron becomes a little smaller. And when the animal switches back to the original block, then the response gets bigger again. So you would think, oh, great, we found a place in the brain where the information about the sound is already influenced by the meaning of such sound. But when you record from hundreds of cells in the auditory cortex, you find that only 15% of the cells actually show something like this, while most of them have a very reliable representation of the sound independent of what the meaning of such a sound is.
Is this from primary or secondary?
This is primary auditory cortex, yeah. And then when you go to the thalamus to ask similar questions to what was asked earlier, what, like, is this inherited? Where does it happen? Then we find that in the auditory thalamus, particularly the MGB, we find a very similar percentage of responses, so that about 16% of them are modulated, while 80-something percent are not modulated. So what we can conclude so far is that the large majority of neurons in the primary auditory cortex and the MG represent the sounds independent of what the action associated with that sound is. And this doesn't mean that there's not going to be modulation in other paradigms. For example, if you change the amount of reward associated with a sound. I'm talking only about this sound means you will get reward, but sometimes it means you will get it on the right side and you have to go there, and sometimes it means you will get it on the left side and you have to go there. And under these conditions, only about 15% of cells in the primary auditory cortex and the thalamus will be modulated.
Question about the MGN activity in
yeah.
the previous slide. So why is it go down? It gets suppressed?
Yeah, so this is one example. So I don't get to show you the full diversity of responses in the auditory cortex of the thalamus, but this was a nice example selected because it showed the modulation. But this is something that is common to see in both areas of the auditory system, which is sometimes you see a strong onset and a suppression during the sustained presentation of the stimulus, and sometimes a rebound. And this happens in both areas. Yeah. And of course, we see also the sustained. We see some that are all on the onset. And we will see later in an example from a different brain area, there's depending on the frequency that is presented, you will see only an onset response. And then for a different frequency, you see a sustained. And for some other ones, you see something else. OK, so at this point, we wanted to ask, if it's not the auditory cortex or the thalamus, what are the circuits that are implementing this flexibility? Or at what point we can find different representations of the sound depending on the action?
So I would probably, I mean, I guess a lot of work shows that, right, the primary auditory cortex is probably not yet the site where these decisions are made. But on the other hand, if you do show that 15% of neurons actually are modulated by that, then you seem to prove the opposite point, right? Even though 85% are not, but you need only one neuron in the extreme case.
That at least one shows something. Yes.
Yes, if you find 15%, which is a
that's right. And I guess the decision at that point is, do you want to make a career out of 15% of cells, or do you want to find, kind of explore more globally the circuit to see really how information is being transformed? It could be that that 15% of cells is a special class of cells in a particular layer that receives particular inputs and goes to a particular place. And that's something that we still have to explore.
No, that was my question, if you looked at whether it's a subclass of neurons.
Exactly. And at this point, we haven't. So these were tetrodes implanted from the top. So it was actually challenging to identify the exact laminar location of the recordings. But now we have better tools that will allow us to really characterize each of the layers and see if some of them are special.
So what did you expect? So this seems consistent with many other studies where actually the primary auditory cortex still shows more kind of stimulus related signature and
yep.
not so much so to speak cortical processing. So
that's right. And depending on the crowd I talk to, the expectations are different.
Yeah.
Some people say, well, no, the cortex should, you know, cognition, cortex, and it has to happen there. And some people say, like, no, cortex is,
primary,
you know, it's the primary auditory cortex, so you just relay things. So I went agnostic and I just measured. And let me tell you the rest of the story and we'll see what happens. Yes?
So 15% auditory cortex, that's over 10 million or something. Is that in one animal?
No, so I'm showing you here the one example for each of the kind of measurements we make. But of course, this has been validated across many animals and across many sessions.
So just simple narrative-wise, the story is 15% of neurons in auditory cortex of a given animal.
Yes.
Okay.
Give me any animal that doesn't seem to have any weird disorders, and you will likely find 15% of the cells if you're not biased towards a particular layer, a particular class of neurons.
How did you measure the activity? Was it tetrodes, you
say? Yeah, that's right. So in this case, we had 8 different tetrodes implanted into the primary auditory cortex, and then when you're lucky, you get a few, let's say 2 to 3 cells per tetrode. So you can record a few simultaneously. But our analysis, and I want to emphasize that. So the techniques for analysis that we're using right now are the classical thing where you record from many cells at once, but then you really study one at a time later. And then you kind of average. And of course, now we're transitioning to studying what happens to the population because maybe there is more information in the population than the individual neurons.
Okay.
But does that answer your question? So
just spike sorted on every cell that you could capture with those 8 electrons.
That's correct. So we're measuring extracellularly many cells, then we do spike sorting to identify which ones are identified, and then we analyze each one individually. Yes. Andrea first.
Do you say anything about layers or about cell type based on
So from waveforms, we analyze only the kind of, as you presented, so the fast, narrow spikes versus the broader spikes, and we didn't see a difference with respect to which cells were modulated. So there wasn't anything to say there. I cannot say much about the layers, so that's still in the pipeline to be studied. Yeah.
The 15% you mentioned, that's the 15% of the cells that actually respond to the auditory stimulus?
That is correct.
So there are, it's less than 50% in the entire...
Yes, and of course, because we're doing our analysis for one, well, actually, let's talk about it here. We're presenting one sound. Remember that in this task, only a subset of sounds are actually switching their meaning. So we have to find cells that respond to those sounds. And here's something we can compare. Monkey experiments have been traditionally done that you find a cell, then you try to find the receptive field of that cell, and you do the study, let's say attention study, for the receptive field of that cell. In this case, we do it kind of the other way around. We define the task first, because the challenge here is to train the animal to perform this particular task. And then we record many neurons, hoping that some of them respond to the stimuli that we present. And we analyze those. Does that make sense? OK. So now let's start asking questions that are not traditionally asked when everything that I've shown you can probably do in the in non-human primates just fine. But if we want to ask questions about what areas are necessary, then we need to start in activating circuits, and then maybe it gets a little more challenging in primates and easier in rodents. So what are the pathways that are necessary to perform this flexible task? Is the cortical pathway really necessary? Or could we have just a thalamic pathway that is, in a way, sufficient to perform this task? And to do this, we started by inactivating, or in this particular case, ablating completely the auditory cortex. So we're removing about 98% of the primary auditory cortex, a little more than 90% of the secondary areas of the auditory cortex, and we're testing how these animals, in this case it's rats, perform the switching task. And what we find is that an animal that before the lesion is performing like this, switching back and forth between these two contingencies, performs very similarly without the auditory cortex. So if we overlay, in this particular example animal, we overlay the two sets of curves, and we see that there's basically no effect. In some other animals, what we find is that there is a decrease in the performance of the task, but the animals can still switch back and forth even without the auditory cortex. In contrast, when we electrolytically lesion the auditory thalamus, so the MG and some of the surrounding areas, the animal couldn't perform the basic task. In this case, it's not that the animal doesn't switch back and forth, it's that the animal has a hard time associating the sounds to the particular places he needs to go. So then the psychometric curves become flat. And what this implies is that a pathway through the auditory thalamus seems to be sufficient to perform this task, and the cortex is not necessary. Yes?
Did you see whether animals can learn the task without an auditory cortex?
No, we haven't done that yet. And that is a common question that we need to go back to the lab and really do it. Is the question, of course, is can the animals learn the discrimination task without the cortex? Or are the effects only present after the animal has learned it? So we don't have an answer yet. And there is another caveat here, which is people have found differences when you ablate the cortex the way we do it here, for example, or with chemical lesions, compared to doing temporary inactivations, either with musimol or optogenetics. So in this case, what we argue is not that the cortex is not doing anything. If you have a cortex, you will use that cortex to send information somewhere. But if you don't have it, the system has sufficient hardware to implement the task. Right? Did you have a question?
No, I think it's more common because I think there's another finding in the motor cortex, by dense association,
yep.
where they remove the motor cortex after learning, and they also show no.
It's consistent with that. Yeah, and I think that's probably related to what you were asking, which is, do you remember the result when they removed the cortex before the animals learn?
I think they cannot train it anymore if they remove the cortex.
Yeah, so that's something, that would be the hypothesis.
Or only to a certain extent. Yeah,
that would be a possible hypothesis here. I have to say, in the this is reminiscent of the fear condition in literature, where they removed the auditory cortex, the animals could still express the fear conditioning to sounds through a thalamus to amygdala pathway. But I believe that without the auditory cortex, the animals could still learn the fear conditioning. So that's, you know, there's evidence on both sides, and we'll have to explore in our task and see what happens. So if there is a thalamic pathway that could mediate this task, then what areas of the brain, what cells could be mediating this process? And what we want to know then is, what are the other outputs of the auditory thalamus? And you're probably familiar with outputs to the auditory cortex and outputs to the amygdala, but I'm going to show you that there's also a strong output to the striatum directly from the auditory thalamus. And our task, being a reward-related learning task, suggests that the striatum may be involved in this process. So here's an example from the Alan Connectivity Atlas of what happens if you inject a tracer, anterograde tracer, in the auditory thalamus. Then you will see terminals in the cortex, but you also see projections both in the amygdala and the the caudal side of the striatum, the dorsal striatum in rodents. So the circuit is going to be something like this, where the information goes up to the auditory thalamus and the auditory cortex with some feedback, and both areas, the thalamus and the cortex, will be projecting to the caudal region of the striatum. And we can verify this by injecting a retrogradely traveling virus in the striatum and see cells both in the auditory cortex and the auditory thalamus. So now let me give you an idea of how this part of the striatum relates to the striatum, the dorsal striatum part that people usually talk about. So we have here the auditory thalamus. This is the brain of a mouse oriented in this direction. And then we have the auditory cortex here, primary and secondary areas. And then this is the dorsal striatum. Now, most people have studied the anterior part of the dorsal striatum. But the part that receives auditory signals is all the way to the back. It's only this caudal tail that is receiving the auditory signals, both from thalamus and cortex. So one question we had was, what is the role of the cells in that particular part of the striatum? Are they doing the same as the ones in the front of the striatum, and are they necessary for sound action associations? So first, we perform some pharmacological inactivations in that part of the striatum during the task. In this case, is just a simple discrimination task, high versus low. And an animal that was performing a very nice psychometric curve, when we have mucimol in the striatum, his psychometric curve goes flat. And of course, we have verified this in many animals. But again, we don't know yet if the posterior part of the striatum was doing something similar to what the anterior striatum was doing. And something that we could test was, what happens if we activate these neurons in the striatum? Are they related, like the ones in the front, to action selection and movement initiation? So let me tell you a little bit about the striatum for those who are not familiar with the circuitry there. Most cells in the striatum are median spiny neurons, more than 95% of them. And there are two main classes, ones that express the D1 dopamine receptor that form the direct pathway. And when you activate them, you usually initiate movement. And another set of cells, at about half and half, that express the D2 dopamine receptor and form the indirect pathway. And when this pathway is activated, it usually stops movement. So what we do is, we have a mouse that expresses channel rhodopsin in only the direct pathway neurons in the whole striatum, and we can shine light and activate them at will, right? So here are the spikes generated by a neuron when we shine light onto them, and we measure that reliably activated. Now, what we can do is we can implant optical fibers into the mouse bilaterally and then activate one side first and then the next side and see what happens to the animal. So let's do this first in the part of the striatum that has been studied mostly, which is in the front. Here is what happens when you have fibers in the anterior part of the striatum in an animal that is just in a box without any pores or anything, just walking around. What you're going to see is that there's going to be a light that appears here or here. That's just for us, not for the mouse to see. And that indicates the left side of the brain is activated, or the right side of the brain, in this case the striatum, is activated. And what you will notice is that every time the activation appears, the animal rotates. So we basically have a remote control mouse. When we shine light on the right side, the animal turns to the left. If we shine light on the left side of the striatum, the animal turns to the right. Okay? And this is just replicating results that other labs have found previously when activating the anterior striatum. Now, here's a quantification of what happens. If we do it in the anterior striatum, then we see a large head angle change, both for the left side and the right side. But when we do the same in the auditory striatum, the posterior side, we don't see much of a change. So this indicates that there's something different about the circuits. It's not just movement initiation. But notice what happens if we do the same stimulation when the animal is performing the task. So now we're going to have the same stimulation in the posterior part of the striatum when the animal is performing the task. And what we see is that stimulation of the left side biases the animal, the responses of the animal, toward the right side. And then stimulation on the right side biases the animal's responses to the left side. So again, to summarize this part is, if the animal is not performing a task, activating these cells doesn't really result in any overt behavior. But if we stimulate it during the task, and the stimulation I didn't mention here, but the stimulation happens concurrent with the sound stimulation. So the animal is hearing the sound, and at the same time we're stimulating these cells, and we shut them down at the end of the sound so that the animal can make a decision, and he tends to make different decisions. So what happens then if we record from these neurons in the striatum? Yes?
What do you know about the connectivity of those mediastinal neurons in the posterior striatum? Are they also
their output
cells to the...
So they are output cells. They go to the usual places of substantia nigra and globus pallidus, but they seem to be organized. They don't go to the same places of substantia nigra that the anterior striatum would go. So it seems like this kind of organization from front to back is preserved even at the level of the substantia nigra.
Can you speculate the, why the animal needs to be engaged in the task in order to unmask the movement?
So let's talk about this data first and we go back to that, because the story is not very clear. There are some hypotheses, but we still need to have some experiments to really rule some of them out. Let me show you what happens if we record from neurons in that part of the brain and try to understand what the role of these neurons would be. So first, if you record from this area and you present many different sounds and you give this activity to an auditory physiologist, I don't think the physiologist would be able to tell that you recorded from the striatum and not from the auditory cortex or the auditory thalamus. So the signals look very similar. In this case, this is one particular neuron, and we're presenting sounds at different frequencies, and sometimes you see a sustained response around 10 kilohertz. Sometimes you see a little bit of suppression. So I was saying earlier that you see all these kinds of responses. Sometimes it's just an onset. And these are the type of responses that you see for simple sounds in the auditory cortex as well. Now, what happens when we ask the question of same sound but different actions? In this case, the way we're going to do it first is by, if we have a full psychometric curve, there are some sounds that 50% of the time the animal goes to the right and 50% of the time the animal goes to the left. So let's see what happens if we split those trials and compare the responses. And what we find is that while some cells, in this case this one doesn't respond much, but you can see a little difference between when the animal goes to the left side, there is a strong response. If the animal goes to the right side, it's a little smaller. But again, most of the cells respond reliably independent of the meaning of the sound. And if we look at the percentages again, like we did for the auditory cortex and thalamus, the percentages are very similar. It's something between 10 to 16% of cells that are modulated, while most of them are reliable. representing the sound. And of course, we can do the same measurements under the task, the switching task that I presented earlier. So now the animal is switching back and forth between these two contingencies, and then we measure again, and we find something similar. Some cells are going to be modulated, some cells are going to have a stable representation, and the percentages, again, are similar. And we could argue the same thing. Is this a special type of cell? And maybe we're missing, just by recording the pool of cells, we won't be able to see what's special about them. So let me wrap it up here to this idea of where are the signals flowing from the ear to the muscle to allow an animal to respond differently to different sounds under this particular paradigm that we've been studying. And what we find so far is that there is an auditory thalamostriatal pathway that seems to be necessary for the animal to perform the task and be able to switch back and forth. But even at the level of the auditory striatum, or the caudal tail of the striatum, the representations of sounds are stable independent on what action the animal is about to perform. This has to be placed in the context. This is just a particular result for a particular task. And I want to emphasize the differences of this task with potential other tasks. So one of them is, remember that when the animal hears the sound, that sound always means reward, but it means reward in different places. So if we're not arguing here that cells along the pathway, in particular in the striatum, are representing changes in the value of the stimulus, because the stimulus always means reward. But they are not modulated by the particular location or the particular action that the animal has to perform. So with this, I want to go back to the main questions we had. And what I wanted to illustrate with this example is that using rodents, we can efficiently go from characterizing the psychophysics of relatively complex tasks. And we didn't get to talk about computational models, but we can talk about that later if anyone wants. We can explore relatively, like, efficiently the different areas that are through which representations of the stimulus and actions are changing in the pathways, and we can get to questions about how the flexibility is implemented. And with this, I want to thank the people in my lab who collected the data and did all the analysis, and some collaborators both at the University of Oregon and other places, and sources of support. Thank you.
So when you look at these neurons that are that do show differences between the two different tasks, how much did you do a statistical analysis? So in other words, how reliable are these differences? Or how many repeated iterations between go left, go right, and so on, did you look at that?
Yeah, so if we look at the, so it depends, I guess we don't have the numbers here, but it depends on how many trials the animals perform in a task. So let's take this task, where the animal is switching back and forth. In this particular case, when we do physiological recordings, we don't perform the whole psychometric. We actually present only the extreme sounds, so 3, 7, and 16, so that we have more data to work with. The animals get to do, let's say, blocks of 200 trials each. And in each block, half of the trials are of, let's say, 7 kilohertz. So let's say we have 100 trials here. And they don't do 100% of them correctly, but let's say 80 to 90%. So we're going to get 80 trials, sometimes let's say 80 trials here, 80 trials here, maybe 60 on the third block. So that's the number of trials we're working with. But that's a good question. So the question could be phrased as, we don't see the effects because the statistics, the number of spikes that we measure are not large enough. But it's not just that we don't see a significant effect, is that the modulations are relatively small.
Well, also, let's say, if you look at the blocks, so you have three blocks, basically, or is this just a sketch, or how many blocks do you have?
Yeah, so most of the time, we collect three, sometimes four blocks. And we wanted to do that to make sure that when we switch once and we see a modulation activity, it's not just due to something that happens to the cell throughout the task. Maybe the cell is representing how much time is elapsed, how hungry, thirsty you are. So we want to be able to go back to the original block and see the change back, of course. Yes?
I don't know, is it generally true that the cell on the left looks a bit more flexible in general? Like,
what do you mean by flexible?
So not only the response to the sound, then there's the second part.
Oh, exactly. So all these parts.
So is it like this is common or this is just for the...
Yeah, so we have to be careful on how we interpret other parts of the trial. So right before the sound is presented, we expect the animal to be in the center port doing exactly the same thing, which is nothing, we hope, during at least 200 milliseconds. So that is something that we can compare across trials. In this particular cell, we see that there are less spikes. It seems to be less spikes here than here. So that could be a reliable effect that we're studying. But what happens after has to be interpreted carefully because the animal is in a completely different state. So after 100 milliseconds, the animal is allowed to withdraw and go to the port. So he's going to start rotating his head. He's going to be moving in a different direction, pointing the head in a different direction. He's going to be touching different whiskers. He's going to be doing all kinds of things. And somewhere here, the animal is going to be reaching the reward port and start collecting the reward, the water reward. And I didn't mention, but all this analysis is also for the correct trials, so that so it has to be the same. We make sure that the animal is performing the task correctly.
I was curious whether the cells that actually are flexible in the response are just more flexible in general. Maybe they are like more allocated to actually code context, while others are more allocated to...
Yeah, and we're still exploring that. We're exploring what are the kind of correlations between the effects we find here and any effects that we find in other stages of the task. Again, with the caveats that we have to be comparing the same condition, let's say the animal has to be in the same place doing the same thing if we want to compare activity between trials. Yes?
So again, back to connectivity questions, but from the afferent side, from the thalamus and the auditory cortex, these medium spine neurons have a couple of properties that suggest very selective connectivity because they're both more or less neuroband tuned.
So yeah, so we have this one example here, right?
Yeah.
And we're characterizing, we can discuss later, I'll show you some data we have with respect to how variable this this tuning is across the different cells. But to the question of what exactly they receive, so our lab and others are still characterizing this connectivity. So we know that they receive projections from primary in the rodent primary auditory cortex, layer 5 neurons, and it's still unclear what exact nuclei in the auditory thalamus are sending information. One of the projects in the lab is characterizing what is different between these two sources of information. So we're actually doing retrograde labeling of the thalamic inputs and the cortical inputs and comparing those two sets of cells. But this is still work in progress, and we don't have a good detailed characterization of what information they're receiving.
Yeah, so the second way they seem kind of specifically wired is that the task modulation, the fraction of task modulated cells is very similar across these three areas.
That's correct.
So that's, to me, doesn't sound like a many-to-one pattern of connectivity. It's not as if the medium spiny neurons are seeing highly convergent.
Yeah, like that. I agree. That seems to be consistent with that. And the puzzle here is, why is the activity so similar between these three areas? And if so, it seems like our paradigm, our behavioral paradigm, is not the correct one to dissociate the roles of these three areas because they're behaving in a similar way. So we have to find under what conditions these areas are performing different roles. And what I was saying, part of what we're studying, the difference between this pathway and this pathway, one example is the representation of amplitude modulations in the thalamus and the cortex and how you are very synchronized to the envelope at the level of the thalamus, but not so much at the level of the cortex where there is a representation of, kind of a rate representation of that modulation. And we're trying to see how that information converges here. Because what if those neurons are receiving both of them, then what do they do? And hopefully we get to answer a little more of that question of the convergence between the pathways and how much, like, is there just a one-to-one connectivity between cortex and striatum? Because maybe at the level of striatum, you're just integrating another input and you still need to have this disorganization. And I didn't mention, but the striatum, at least in the rat, also has what we could call a tonotopy, a tonotopic map. So there's organization from the medial side to the lateral side where neurons have a preference for different frequencies. Yes?
What do you think would happen if you presented a sound that was not relevant to the discrimination? You have a continuum of frequencies.
That's right, yeah.
And you've got a neat spectrum, a neat paradigm, because the stimuli always have some value as opposed to irrelevant. What happens if you introduce a sound?
So something that is not a clear, defined frequency?
Something that is not a cue that the animal...
Yes. It's very rare that the animals go into the center, hear a sound. For the sounds that we present, it's very rare to see an animal just go hear a sound and say, like, huh, I don't know what that is. I'm just going to wait here and start another trial. They always go to one side or the other. But we haven't explored what you mentioned exactly, which is let's show something that doesn't have a clear frequency content. So I don't know, maybe something broadband that includes both frequencies. What would the animal do? I would imagine the animal is going to go to one side or the other because their motivation is really strong to get water, and it's better to go somewhere and get have the chance of getting something 50-50 than not a chance. But we haven't explored it in detail. Do you have a particular prediction, or are you thinking of a particular model?
It's really a fascinating situation where all the stimuli have value, which is, you know, it's different from, say, a go-no-go experiment.
Right. Yeah.
A class of stimuli where the effect of the stimulus is to prevent them from making a response.
Yes, and we do have a preference for these two alternative choice tasks because we know, and also having the self-initiation of the animal, because we know the animal is going to be engaging the task when we present the stimulus, mm-hmm. and we will have better statistics from, we know that the animal performed a response,
yeah.
so we know what the animal was thinking at that moment. Even if it was something like, I don't know what this sound was, I'm still going to try to go to the other.
So what is now your direction of conclusion? You essentially, you cannot find the new correlate of this behavioral pattern. Maybe because these neural patterns are related across different regions, or is it because there should be another metric neural measure which may reflect this new correlate, or is it beyond? I don't know. Could it be?
That's a good question. Yeah, that's a great question. So the naive approach would be to say, well, this part of the striatum is still far from the muscle, so maybe we just need to keep following the loops and pathways until we get to a place. If we measure in the muscles, we for sure find different activity when the animal goes to the left and when the animal goes to the right. So somewhere in the pathway, the information has to change. That's one approach. The other idea that you mentioned is maybe we are not measuring the right neural signature. Maybe the way these signals are selected are in a different way. I would argue that at the level of the muscle is probably a rate coding, like having more spikes in a particular set of motor neurons will drive the animal to one side or the other. So at some point, it has to be converted into that simple code, but we don't know at what point. So that's a valid question. And something else I want to argue about these tasks, we've had great success with these tasks, but there is something that is not ideal about them, which is not having a particular neural substrate that clearly defines the exact action the animal has to perform. So if you think about experiments in primates, when they do with saccades, you have a particular set of neurons that when you activate them, the animal performs a very clear saccade. In this case, the movement, the decision and the movement of the animal is more complex. It's a whole rotation of the body to go to one side. So we only have kind of a hint into this, what elicits this behavior, but we are transitioning to other behaviors where we can really control or have a more specific delineation of what creates the behavior, and we try to connect the sensation to action in a better way. Did you have a question?
Yeah, in the stimulation experiment, have you ever tried to stimulate like both sides at the same time?
So when we do it in the front, are you talking about the front or during the task in the back?
In the back, of course, and then do you see the same like psychometric curve, or does it actually flatten out completely because there's too much activity in the...
Let me see if I remember, because I don't think we have run during the task stimulating both sides. There is something challenging about that, which is it's really hard to really balanced out the same stimulation on both sides. Just because of the positioning of the fibers to stimulate, the amount of power that you're really producing, because you can measure before you implant, but once you implant, you don't know what happens to the tip of the fiber. So I wouldn't trust the experiments completely, because it's hard to really stimulate the same number of neurons with the same amount. But we haven't run it, so we don't know. Yeah. Did you have another comment?
Yeah, it's related to Jim and Torsten's question. So if you could bring up the last slide that you had where there was the two roster graphs. I was just curious if they're not this one. This one. I was just wondering if there's more to your data and kind of the analysis kind of takes. Like, for example, the one on the left, the low block, which is above the high block, is there like some sort of expectation that's kind of there initially and then it kind of goes away? And, you know, so maybe you're just kind of, your analysis is kind of looking at a very low dimensional representation of what the neuron's doing, but there is data there that might kind of indicate something else is going on.
Yes, and I'll tell you a couple of things that we've been thinking about. So, and this kind of gets a little bit of how we're going to study the question of how this flexibility is implemented. And maybe I should, how are we doing with time?
So we have cookies in 3 minutes.
3 minutes.
Okay. How much time do we need that?
We can talk about this offline, but I can tell you briefly. So there are two main models of how this flexibility could be implemented. One is from sensation to action, you're changing synaptic strengths so that the same sound sometimes drives this action and sometimes the other action. Alternatively, you could have a sensory motor pathway that is always the same, but you have influence from the top. So you have a top-down attentional signal, if you will, that is modulating that. And that second model would maybe indicate that if you see here, we were mentioning earlier, that maybe there are less spikes here than here. So at the population level, there is some top-down signals that are placing the system in a different state. And that's what's going to drive, when the same stimulus comes, you will drive the animal one way or the other. So there are other things in the data to explore. What happens before the animal hears the sound is one of them.
I was thinking more of the change. Is time going forward, going up?
So time and time is that way. So you're saying, yeah, time is going that way.
I don't know. You can't see the trend. Was there a low or a high to low block before? Like, I'm just wondering, is this neuron kind of, as you go from a high to a low block, then there's already some sort of expectation for the sound leading into it, and
yes,
then that's why right at the bottom of the green one.
And I will be careful with overinterpreting the one neuron, but I'll be happy to go through some data with you and, like, let's try to find hypotheses that we can go test at the population level. So I agree. And with that, I think I should stop and let everyone enjoy the cookies.
Thank you very much again.